You are listening to Invest in the Future by Future Africa. Future Africa is a platform connecting mission-driven innovators and investors looking to turn Africa's most difficult challenges into global business opportunities. Please note that the content of this podcast is not to be regarded as investment advice.
So we're going to get started. Welcome everyone to Invest in the Future. Invest in the Future is a life asset chat series by Future Africa, where we talk to the most prolific investors and startup founders who are building the future of the continent. Future Africa is a platform that backs startups with coaching, capital, and community. You can learn more about us at www.futureafrica. So let's just get started. Today we have with us Yele Bademosi, who is the founder and CEO of Bondo Africa, and was also the founding partner of of early stage VC firm Microtraction. So Yele, would you like to introduce yourself? And then we'll get right into it.
I think you've already done the introduction.
I feel like there's more.
But hi, everyone. As Bin just said, I'm blessed or fortunate enough to wear two hats on both sides of the table. One where I'm a founder of Bondo, I used to call it a social payments app for cash and crypto. But now I was a social trading app for crypto. And then also founded Microtraction, an early stage investment fund for technology entrepreneurs on the continent. Personally, what drives me is accelerating Africa's transition to a sustainable and developed economy. And when I say Africa, I mean Africans. So giving individuals the ability to achieve economic freedom and financial stability.
Okay. So I want us to get started by talking about your career. I don't think many people know that you were almost a doctor. So can you share your story of what that was like moving from medicine or health, if you will, to technology?
Yeah, I mean, sure. So I grew up in Nigeria. My dad was a doctor. My elder sister wanted to be a doctor. My aunt was a doctor. My uncles were doctors. And when you think about, the context of Nigeria at the time, if you were doing well in school, medicine was kind of the thing that you were nudged towards. And I wasn't really sure what else I wanted to do with my career or my life, to be honest. I never really gave it a lot of thought. And so I just went with the flow, got into medical school at King's College London. But I probably went to less than 10 lectures. I mean, I think I've even been overly ambitious there, but generous to myself. More like 5 lectures in my first year. And I used to tell my friends that I was never going to practice medicine, but I thought I was going to finish. I think as I got older, I began to just think like, what do I want to do in my life? And I knew it wasn't medicine. So the question was, if it wasn't medicine, then what else was there, right? And I've always been very big with like entertainment, music, the creative industry. And so I read this book called The Billion Dollar Bet. It's about the founding story of BET, so Black Entertainment Television. And at the time, Afrobeats was just getting popular in London, in universities over there. And, I used to do this top 10 countdown or top 20 countdown on Facebook that was quite popular. And I wanted to turn that into like a website. Like I thought I was going to build, the BET for Africa, but online. Somehow that transitioned into a social, mobile app where I learned how to code and learned how to design. I never built that website, but that was sort of how I made that transition. But there's a bunch of stuff in between, which is, you know, convincing my friends and family that I wasn't crazy. You know, I remember reading TechPoint when I was in the UK and seeing Mark Essien raise $1 million. For me, that was like a huge thing, because here was a African founded VC firm funding, and, you know, a Black Nigerian African founder. And so it showed me that, you know, there was potential for tech in Nigeria and on the continent. And, you know, it made me a lot more comfortable about this idea of wanting to transition away from more traditional, linear, you know, very predictable paths to kind of what I do now. And you know, when I look back at my career, I don't think I could have predicted at any point, like, oh, this is what I was going to be doing in 1 year. So I can't predict what I'll be doing in 12 months from now, man. Maybe yeah. I'll do something else.
I feel the same way. So what was your very first, entry into like the technology ecosystem in Nigeria? What was like your first job or something that you worked, yeah, project that you worked on?
Yeah, so I moved back to Nigeria in December 2015. I'd never lived in Lagos. I grew up in Ibadan. And so my very good friend, Kitoye, who also happens to be someone that wears like the technology hat and is also like an artist. So I used to come to his house and I would sort of sleep on the couch. You know, spend like a week in Lagos, then go back to Ibadan, do 2 weeks, then I'll come back to Lagos, spend like 1 week or 2 weeks. I was just trying to figure out, like, you know, what the hell I was going to do. So I applied for a number of roles. I actually got one. I don't want to mention the companies, but some of them are well known today. I think I always joke that I always had like the idea of being a VC in me, because like the two companies that I wanted to work for, I've kind of gone on to do, you know, quite well. But none of them were really a right fit in terms of, you know, the three key objectives I had for myself. So the first one was I wanted to get a job that would allow me to move to Lagos full time. The second one was I needed a job that gave me the flexibility to figure out what I wanted to do in Lagos long term. And then the final one was really about doing something that allowed me to build my networks, right? I think a lot of people underestimate networking. And by networking, I don't mean, you know, going to events in the hopes of meeting people. I mean like intentional networking, and hopefully we can sort of touch on some of those points later on. But essentially, you know, I was fortunate enough to connect with Dotun. I read this, I think it was a blog post on Tech Cabal, and it was Dotun, I think it was called like the Returning Angel's Perspective on the Lagos Tech Ecosystem. And the points he raised were, you know, very, very, I was in agreement with every single point. And then there was this kind of byline of, oh, he's about to start this thing, you know. So I messaged Dotun via email, and I was like, hi, it was on Christmas Day, either Christmas Day or Christmas Eve. So I was like, hi, Dotun, you don't know me. I'm Yele, just moved back. I like the sound of what you're working. Here are the things I can do for you. You don't have to pay me money. And he responded quite quickly and was like, oh, let's chat the next day. So we jumped on a call, and that was how I started my work with Starter. And Starter, for those who don't know, because we've, you know, I think it got acquired, but it was essentially an online community and resource platform for current and future African entrepreneurs. And, you know, I did a lot of community work, both online and offline, email marketing. And a lot of my background and my experiences with growth comes from that. And then alongside that, we also had a consulting business that was trying to help SMEs or traditional businesses apply sort of startup growth technology, startup growth ideologies or methodologies to traditional businesses. So for instance, we worked with like Cafeneo, and that was how I kind of met more people in tech, and you know, the rest is history.
That's a really interesting background. I feel like everyone we've had on this show has had like a very diverse background, and they have like a very non-traditional traditional path into tech. So how did the opportunity to found MicroTraction start? So you had worked at Startup for a bit with Dotun. I believe Dotun also has a fund that he manages, if I'm wrong.
So
Dotun, but how did MicroTraction start anyway?
Yeah. So I think like I never thought about being a VC. One of Dotun's, I think, you know, full credit to Dotun, one of his contacts reached out and said she was looking for, or they're looking to hire someone to work as a VC analyst. And so I applied for the role, and I really just enjoyed the idea of thinking about investing and working with entrepreneurs. Especially because at the time, like I was still trying to figure out of the number of ideas that I had, what did I want to do? Unfortunately, I wasn't successful in that job application. I always joke that I don't have a finance background, right? So for like later stage VC firms, like having that background, especially at least then, was quite important. Especially if you don't have a founder background. So I didn't necessarily have a track record that, you know, a large VC firm would say, oh, let's hire Yele or Yele, you know. It kept me thinking. Again, through networking, there was a period when, in 2016, when Michael Sibu from YC, Monique from 500, Tyler from TechStars, and a bunch of host of other investors, you know, all visited Nigeria. That was the the Ingressive Tour of Lagos. I think that was probably one of the most impactful sort of summers in the entire tech ecosystem. I don't think we've had another summer as impactful, in my opinion, because it really opened up the doors for the vast majority of entrepreneurs who couldn't raise capital from the local ecosystem. And that was the conduit or bridge. During that same time period, I got connected to Kwamina, who's also one of the founding partners of MicroTraction. I told him, I was like, I would like to work for you. He was like, I'm not trying to hire anyone. And, you know, I was like, damn, here, another failure, you know, but he was like, yeah, you know, I like partnerships. Let's figure out something that we can do together. So one of the events during this summer, a bunch of the investors were complaining about like YC and 500 and TechStars, you know, increasing the valuation of startups in the ecosystem, you know. And Michael was like, well, if you guys could complain, or you could just start investing earlier, you know. And it was like this watershed moment of, if you created an angel fund, so you, they're not, at the time, there weren't a lot of angel investors. So if you institutionalized angel investing, then you could potentially find really good companies or founders before anyone else, you know. And that was sort of the core idea of MicroTraction. And myself and Kwamina were like on the same table, and we kind of like looked at each other like, maybe this is what we should do, you know. And we spoke about it. Michael, you know, forever bullish in Africa, was like, you know, if you guys are doing this thing, let me know, and I'm gonna invest. And we put a small fund together and started in, and, you know, within a year started investing in tech businesses. So to be honest, like, I'm always very grateful because I think like there are huge amounts of luck involved in, you know, meeting Kwame Nah or even, you know, meeting Michael Siebel and some of these other investors on the trip. But I think like what one thing I had done was because of Starter, like, you know, we had this event series we used to run wherein we tried to connect African entrepreneurs with local angel investors. I think it was called like Silicon Drink Up, right? So we would get like cocktails, we'd get like, you know, food, and just create like a chilled and relaxed atmosphere for angels to meet founders in a non kind of demo day type pitching environment. And we were curating the startups for the groups of investors. We did about three or four of these events and not one company got funded. And so at the time I was like, okay, maybe we are just terrible at you know, selecting startups. But something similar was done during this summer and a number of startups ended up getting into YC 500 and the like. So that made me kind of slightly positive about the idea of doing micro traction. And I thought that, okay, you know what, if within 3 years, you know, we could get like one or two companies into YC, like, or into like YC 500 tech stars or raising external capital, that would be like success, right? And, you know, I'll never forget when in the, I think it was either February or March, you know, Timmy from Bitcoins, Timmy Iwe from and Tomowa from Bitcoins and Razak and Edward from CarryWise all called me whilst I was in bed. Like, they got into YC and we were there. I'm sure now like everyone is all like, you know, older and stuff. By the time it was insane, I was there on my bed at like 3 a.m. jumping up my phone and like shouting and because it was insane. You have to understand that before then it was literally just Paystack and Flutterwave,
yeah,
you know, that done YC. And now it seems like the Nigerian companies or African companies doing like YC 500 and Techstars, but then it was like,
it was very rare.
Wow, like, you know, so that was, you know, when I think about what joy feels like, you know, that movie In Pursuit of Happiness, whereby like at the end of the scene, he gets the job and it's like walking out and they like cut the scene.
Yeah.
Like they could have cut my, like, I was in the movie, like, I cut that movie, they're like done because I was just so happy. But now I'm incredibly grateful to, you know, work with entrepreneurs and do the things I, you know, some of the things I've done because it's just a great time to be an African entrepreneur, really.
I absolutely agree. What was your experience like at MicroTraction before a company started getting into YC? Like, now it's commonplace, right? Well, before, like, Bitcoins or CarryWise, what was that experience like, you know, having to find these startups? How did you prove to them that you were going to be of support, aside from just capital? How did you prove that you were going to, you know, be of support to them, especially as a firm? And in what ways did you support them beyond just capital?
Yeah, to be honest, like, that's a very good question. I think number one, there were a lack of options at the time. You know, there weren't that many avenues for entrepreneurs to raise capital, especially at that early stage, you know. And a lot of the teams, like, I was on Twitter, I was DMing founders, we'll meet for coffee. And it was like really easy, you know. Oh, I'm working on, you know, a wallet that would allow people to send and receive money. And here is my background. I used to work at a bunch of banks. Okay, Wallets Africa. To me, and Iri was just like hands down some of the best engineers that I've seen, and who were entrepreneurial. We want to do this Bitcoin thing, I'm in. oh, we're ex, you know, investment bankers. I used to work at MTN, want to build the savings and investment platform. Career-wise, I'm in. You know, like, it was just a bunch of, like, interesting businesses and kind of very ambitious founders who were also taking as much of a chance on me as I was on them, right? So it was very, very mutualistic, you know, compared to a lot of the investors at the time. I think I was 25, right? 25 or 26, 26. Most of the investors at the time were like mid-30s, late 40s.
Yeah, older people signing checks.
You know, so it was like messaging on Twitter, like was very like very chill, very relaxed. And some of the feedback was like, oh, this was not kind of what I expect. Like it's not what I expected from like meeting, right? Like we'll go to people's offices, we'll just like jam, like, you know, so it really felt founder friendly. And to be honest, I think like my skill set as someone in tech has always been three things. I have a very strong product sense. So when it comes to like product strategy and kind of thinking around the curve, I've always been, you know, relatively good at that. I also am a designer. So for instance, Bondo worked, you know, a lot of the early stuff was done by myself and Ugo. Obviously now I don't really have the bandwidth to continue designing. And then growth, right? So how do you go from zero to one? How do you get a first set of users? And I was able to kind of like just help or you know, act as a sounding board and a listening ear for our founders. And that's sort of like majority of what we did. And then to be honest, we just focused on growth and we're fortunate enough to get these guys, or rather, like I always say, it's the founders, right? I think as investors, we want to kind of prop up what we do, but like, I really don't believe that investors make as much difference as we would like to claim. You know, the founders are driving the ship.
I'm inclined to agree with you. So let's go a bit forward. So you're running MicroTraction and it's going well and absolutely well. Two questions I think we would segue into this. The first is, how did you discover cryptocurrency? I know you were at Binance Labs for a bit. So how did you discover that side of, you know, technology? Like what attracted you to it?
Yeah. So, I mean, like, everything good happens on Twitter, right? So, to me, like, the first part about Bitcoin, I was still in school or not. I was in this kind of middle of in school, but not in school, but getting ready to drop out kind of situation. And I had this friend whose dad or uncle that sent her, like, Bitcoin. And so, she told me about this website called Coinbase. I think on one of my laptops, I still have my screenshot of Coinbase because I was like, oh, I like this design, you know, and I was like, I would like to recreate. I think I actually recreated it somewhere. But I never really went beyond that. And obviously I'm like, damn, I should have bought Bitcoin at that price. You know, but when I really got deeper into crypto was probably around 2017. And that was just because at the time, pretty much all the US investors I followed were all talking about Bitcoin and this thing, Ethereum, around the same time. And a few things really struck my mind that early on. So personally, when I think about like Africa and the context of economic development, you know, we would like to think that tech or traditional tech, as I call it these days, is going to be the conduit through which we change things. You know, but when you look at any economy that has changed or evolved over time, the role of government is massive. The government has to create enabling environments and technologies and policies that drive and make innovation and capitalism or capital work. Unfortunately, our parents' parents have been waiting for our governments to get, you know, their acts together. I do think that is a function of incentives. And as long as incentives are aligned in the current direction that they are, we will be waiting another 34 years to see any kind of systemic change. Now, the beauty of crypto is this. For the first time, you can have individuals who don't know or trust each other coordinate economically at scale, right? And I'll say that again. The reason why we have governments is to create the rule of law and create kind of like platforms that allow economic activity to happen. Otherwise, without governments, there will be no law and order and everything descends into chaos, right? And so you need governments for protection, for contracts, for law and order, and, you know, provision of basic amenities. And the government essentially coordinates excess resources towards the public good. Now, with blockchains and digital assets, when you think about like something like Bitcoin that is not owned by anyone, and you have a variety of independent actors all working towards the same goal, or you think about Ethereum and all the value that has been built on top of that, or, you know, more recently Binance Smart Chain, that is pretty unique. And so for me, this idea that we could build a completely separate economic and financial system that wasn't dependent on legacy infrastructure was something I just couldn't take my, you know, I couldn't not focus on. And I always just say that when I'm a student of anthropology, and I, you know, looked at the history of tech in terms of, you know, mainframe computing, personal computing, the internet, mobile, social, you know, you think about like, I'm always like, if I was in that particular period, would I have known when these shifts were happening, right? These technology shifts, they seem so obvious in hindsight, but when it's happening, most people don't know. Yeah, and so, right. So for me, I've always been thinking like, I need to make sure that when this happens in my lifetime, in my period, because usually almost every 20 years, there's a shift, right? So for me, I was like, when this is happening, if something seems interesting, I'm going to focus on that. And I think that's what crypto is. And to be honest, like, one thing I tell everyone is that crypto is so new. And it always feels like, I feel like you need to go through two cycles to realize just how new it is. So in 2017 and 2018, during the kind of downturn or the bear market of crypto, I felt like, damn, I missed it, right? But if you see what's happened in the last 6 to 8 months, I'm like, oh my God, like, there are companies and founders that when I was at Binance Labs, like, we were investing in, I was giving advice to, and I see the scale of some of these projects now, and I'm like, wow, there is no way I would have thought this was going to happen in 3 years. Yeah. And what's exciting to me is that as Africans, we've not even started building yet, right? Like, we don't even have that many sort of blockchain or cryptocurrency projects. Now we are beginning to build infrastructure. So there's obviously Luno, there's Bitcoins, there's Busha, there's Bondo, you know, there's Quidax. And in other markets as well, we're seeing kind of like things popping up. But in terms of like actual blockchain projects, like, we don't really have that. And so crypto right now in Africa is like the African tech ecosystem in 2007, right? Wherein if you wanted to hire engineers, there were hardly any engineers, and you had to kind of go to Europe, or you had to go to India. And so a lot of the things that we've focused on is really like saying, okay, how do we teach people how to become blockchain developers, right? Like, I think if Nigerian developers knew how much blockchain developers got paid, everyone wants to be a blockchain developer because it is crazy.
You want to share it in case they're on this call. Do you want to share it?
It is single-handedly the highest paying job you could have. At a minimum, you're probably going to be earning maybe $2,450. And, you know, this is like base. And, you know, go up to $3,000, $4,000. And, you know, if you're working for global companies, you could be earning between $7,000 to $8,000 a month. And that is like on the...
As
Africans, like if you were Europe or you were in Asia or you were in, it would be maybe even, you know, $10,000 upwards.
Anyways, I didn't know that. So I think I'm going to take a blockchain course on Binance. I had no idea. There's a couple of developers on this call. I want to see if they're going to post some questions as we go on. So please, if you have any questions, you can just post them in the Q&A box. When I'm done speaking with Yele, we'll take some of the questions. Okay, so Yele, so from Binance Labs, right? So you've done MicroTraction and Binance Labs. What led you to start Bondo? More specifically, what led you to think, okay, this is the future here, and I want to get in on this, and I see the opportunity to build another, another crypto platform? Because at the time Bondo launched, there were already a couple of, you know, platforms. Mm-hmm. Right? So what led you to start Bondo?
Yeah. So I think, like, for the most part, a lot of people, and I take responsibility for this, a lot of people still don't know what we're trying to do with Bondo. Bondo has never really been about building a crypto exchange or a crypto trading product. For me, Bondo has always been a vehicle through which mass adoption of cryptocurrency or crypto assets happens on the continent. And what I mean by that is crypto solves a lot of problems, but I want to build something that has mass adoption potential, right? So you have to understand that I invested in buy coins through MicroTraction at Binance Labs that done Bitsika, Zend, Yellow Card, all exceptional founders building and sort of solving for different stacks in the space. You know, but I always felt like one thing was really missing, which was, you know, how do you infuse crypto into a product that abstracts away the layer of complexity and can be used by the average person, right? Now, in order to get there, you have to build the core. So internally, we call what we have today at Bondo Core, right? And that is essentially kind of like this wallet and exchange interface to move between different crypto assets. You know, but year two is when we really, really begin to do what we set out to do with Bondo, right? So
when does year two functional?
Now. We just
now, yeah. Okay, I was gonna say it's been a year, so year two, okay.
So you know, obviously with the CBN restrictions and the CBN memo, you know, that set us back a couple of months because we had to kind of like react to that and figure out how to make, you know, figure out ways that still allowed our users to use our products. But essentially, a lot of the stuff we're doing now is going to be very heavy on the social side, very, very heavy on the social side, because I believe that social is what's going to scale crypto, right? And, you know, within the next, fingers crossed, all things being equal, you know, within the next, let's say 3 months, a bunch of these things will be going live. I'm super excited to see how they play out, right? Which is saying, you know, if you've used WeChat before, you know, that has always been my inspiration. I want Bondo to be the WeChat for crypto, and not even from a African perspective. So I think, like, at this point, when I think about, like, our team and, you know, our ambitions, want to play at the global scale. Want to play with you know, crypto is a global problem. We believe that our team and our product is strong enough to, you know, have an impact globally. And that's sort of like what we're trying to do. So with CashLink, we can finally expand into a lot of countries. We're kind of like limited. I mean, I think in the launch article that we had on Forbes, I said we're going to be in 30 countries in year one. So I look back on that and I laugh because I think how naive was I? I didn't know anything. Pan-African payments is hard, you know, but we believe that we've solved that with CashLink. I think I tweeted something the other day. I said, I can't wait for a time when I'm able to explain to the world just some of the things that we've done with CashLink and just how innovative the product is. You know, we're going to launch CashLink. I think my team will kill me now if I put out these timelines because they'll be like,
put it out. So we can have like an investment future exclusive.
You know, but we're gonna launch CashLink in Ghana soon, and you know, we're coming to Kenya very soon. And you know, CashLink reminds me of Uber. You know, it really, really does.
There's actually someone who left a question here and says, "How did you think of CashLink?" Because it's like Uber for cash, and it's a dope African way to approach innovation across around blockades. I was gonna ask you that question. Someone called Michael Kimani. Okay, I know Michael. I think I know Michael. Yeah.
Oh, I know Michael. Hi, South Africa.
Yeah. I know Michael as well.
So to be honest, I think the biggest lesson I've learned in this time period is innovation comes from everyone and everywhere. I definitely wouldn't take credit for CashLink. That's my CTO, Tyro. I remember when he called me that night and was like, "Yeah, I have an idea," because we had so many ideas. We had like ideas upon ideas in terms of how we want to go about this. But we had this framework through which we talked through everything. And so you would have an idea and you would go through the framework and you'll be like 3 out of 5, but it has these two things. You know, you have to understand that we wanted to build something that was legally compliant, right? So our users are not trading or using crypto with their accounts. You know, when you use CashLink compared to other P2P products, it's NGN to NGN. But at the same time, we don't have any bank accounts. At the same time, you know, we're not doing any direct integrations into anybody, but you have to build a system that works, you know. And as we kind of walked through everything, I was like, damn, I think this is it, you know. And we tested it internally, it worked. Obviously they're like challenges because it's essentially a marketplace and it was a new product. We had to teach our users, we had to teach our partners, you know, teach the CashLink partners. But you know, it's been incredible. I might share a graph that shows, I'll take out the numbers, but the graph looks like a V. It's literally like this. This is when the CBN ban happened. 4 weeks later, this is where we were. And I was like, damn, like, are they gonna kill? Is our business gone? And you know, the last kind of like 4 to 6 weeks has just been incredible. And I'm just grateful to work, you know, on this problem and with the people and the stuff that we do.
Yeah. So what's your experience been like, kind of like switching sides in the ecosystem? In the sense that you were on the investing side, even at Binance Lab, you were still on like sort of like on the investing side, and now you're a founder. How has your mindset had to change?
Yeah. I think it's been really interesting. I'm not gonna lie. Being a founder and being an investor is like it's very, very different. As an investor, you have to be very, very curious. You have to have very strong people skills, and you have to be willing to take bets, intentional bets before everyone else. But you're working on so many things at the same time. You're meeting different entrepreneurs. You have your own portfolio companies that have their own issues and their challenges, and you're helping them think through it, meeting other VCs and stuff. So it feels very broad. You know, it feels like a very broad focus area. You know, but as an entrepreneur, it's a lot more focused. You know, you have this a few metrics they are trying to drive up every day, and everything is really centered around this one thing. And I think I've definitely appreciated that focus, and I have so much respect for a lot of founders who build things and, you know, didn't have the same level of resources that, you know, I had. I wouldn't take it for granted that, you know, I had worked at Binance or had access to, like, you know, networks, or, you know, had some, you know, level of trust that made people comfortable working when there was no clear. It wasn't like, oh, this is something that was going to work, right? I think I enjoy both, though, right? So you know, one of my favorite ideas, which my team is always like, when are we going to build this, is I believe Bundle will evolve into an ecosystem whereby developers are building on Bundle, not dissimilar to WeChat and mini programs. Snapchat also has something similar with, like, the mini apps. Yeah. And these companies wouldn't even be built on traditional infrastructure, because at the end of the day, Bundle has a combination of verified identity, a social graph, and, you know, payment channels. So as a, you know, there are lots of startups that apply to MicroTraction that are not venture backable, but it doesn't mean that a founder or one or two founders can build a business that's going to make $50,000, $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
Like, if you build something that made $100,000 a year, that is more than enough money to take care of yourself and, you know, a couple of employees and your family. But unfortunately, that's not venture backable, right? Does that mean that business shouldn't exist? The answer is no. So I've always had this issue or disconnect with the way we kind of force all businesses, all tech-enabled businesses, to be venture or die. You know, and I believe that with some of the things we're building with Bundle, we can allow developers, indie African developers who want to build gaming businesses, entertainment businesses, dating applications, consumer applications, you know, media, like social media or media applications, survive and thrive and monetize. And they don't have to be venture backable, but it wouldn't matter, because through Bundle, they have access to kind of like some of the key things that are very difficult to do on your own.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, have you angel invested in any startups?
No. Because primarily you have to, it can create a conflict of interest. Because the question is, if I'm going to angel invest in you, then why won't MicroTraction invest in you? Yeah. But I'm probably about to make my first two. One is in a friend's company. It's not based in, it's out of scope in terms of like our investment strategy as MicroTraction. So it's UK based and not focused on Africa. And then the second one is a global crypto protocol that I'm super excited about, again, outside of my mandate at MicroTraction.
So part of being a great startup founder is being able to identify and recruit talent. What has your experience been like as the founder of Bundle, and what things have you done to be able to recruit the kind of team that you have? because I know that you have an absolutely stellar team. So how were you able to find them and recruit them and convince them to join this thing that is an absolutely, you know, crazy thing and nobody knows whether it's going to work or not?
So I think, like, number one, you have to articulate what it is you're trying to do. I've always been very clear about why we exist and what we're trying to do. And, you know, I have this document, maybe I might make it public. I think the link is actually public. I just haven't shared the link publicly. It's called Introducing Bundle. It's like a 5-page document that I wrote about Bundle and what we're trying to do, why we exist and the opportunity and stuff like that. So, you know, I shared that with a lot of people that I respect, and they gave me feedback, asked the hard questions. And so being able to paint, you know, a vision for the future and why we exist and the problem we're trying to solve, that's kind of the most important thing. The second thing is, like, Bundle is remote. We're a remote company. I'm not sure if there's another, you know, startup that has sort of reached the scale we have that was fully remote. And we're remote before the pandemic hit, right?
How many people on the team now?
We're currently 24.
That's a lot of people.
But we have a couple of people part-time. But we're gonna scale up rapidly, you know, probably add between about 10 more people in the next like month and a half or something. You know, so being able to work remotely also made it easy for me to convince people that were already working remotely to join Bundle. And then we paid, I like to think we pay well or pay well enough. You know, so again, I think like it's very important. Like when you can afford to pay your people, pay them. And you know, we have stuff like biannual bonuses, which as far as I know, I don't think a lot of people do that, wherein we give people cash bonuses twice a year based on how the company is doing. Because people have the opportunity to choose how they want to spend their time, you know, so it's extremely important. We just hired a people ops person, you know, she's amazing. And I'm like, yeah, you should hire a people ops person as early as possible. So you have one person that is just focused on, like, it's crazy, right? You have user experience designers and you have customer experience teams, but no one really thinks about the employee experience and says, how do we make employees successful in their roles and enjoy the job that they do? And that's been a big learning point for me as a founder. And I think we've only really began to get that right, like really, really right, at the turn of the year. You know, that was kind of like the one consistent feedback. It was like, we love working at Bundle. People are awesome. You know, but it's like 24/7 nonstop go. You know, so I had to kind of take a step back and say, you know what, I love my people. We're going to be successful together and I want them to be on board for a long time. What is the employee experience at Bundle? And that is the sole focus of everything. Like, we have a care team. If you're ill, someone's going to send you food and send you like a care package. You know, we have like an internal cryptocurrency that we're rolling out that is tied to like gift cards and internal rewards. Oh no, that's very different.
You have like Bundle employees have their own internal cryptocurrency.
Yeah, rolling out. But no, I think it's an amazing group of people, and I'm fortunate to build with them every day.
All right, thank you so much. I just have a few more questions, then we'll go into like Q&A and take questions from the public. What's your advice for people who are operators and want to build startups, but are not sure how to find the opportunities to build startups? So how do they begin to see problems, if you will, that are large enough, you know, to solve, or that are important enough to solve?
So is that a question again?
So how would you advise people who are operators right now and want to start startups, but they have a couple of ideas, maybe 2-3 ideas. How do they pick the one that is, you know, going to have the most impact or the one that is a big enough problem that they should solve?
So the biggest thing any entrepreneur should start with is, actually, I was going to say something, but I probably just changed my mind right now. I was going to say markets. But I think you have to start with a painful problem that you're really, really passionate about. As a VC, talking to an entrepreneur, I would say markets, because that is the single most determining factor that any VC looks at when investing in a business. As an entrepreneur, the difficulty of startups make it hypercritical that you have to be super passionate about the problem they're trying to solve or about the vision they're trying to make a reality. So that when things do get hard or when things are not going your way, you are able to keep going. You know, before the CBN memo, we were on such a high. You know, like, I remember I was thinking like, wow, like if someone told me that this was where we're going to be by this time, like I'll be shocked. And then the CBN memo happens and you see your numbers and everything dropping. And it's like, how are we going to make it through this? But obviously as a CEO, I don't tell that to my team. And I maintain kind of like this level of confidence, but you just realize just how difficult startups are. And I think like every founder goes through points whereby it looks like things are not working out, or, you know, are you going to pull through? And if you don't have that kind of like passion about the problem, or you don't care so much about the vision, you're just going to give up and quit, right? So that's probably number one. Choose a problem that doesn't matter how tough things get, you're going to keep going, you're not going to give up. Then the next thing is markets, right? Like, you know, the best way to illustrate this is if you're going to become a professional sports player, you can decide to play football or basketball, or you could decide to play ultimate frisbee. Now, even if you're the best ultimate frisbee player in the world, because, you know, the marketability and the revenue generated from ultimate frisbee is really low, you're not going to earn a ton of money from breaking all the records in ultimate frisbee. Well, the internet has changed things, so who knows? But if you're the best football player, or even if you're playing in the Premier League, you're making a ton of money, right? So choosing markets is very important, because when you choose a market that is big enough and is fast growing, you end up doing, you know, really well. It's like shoot, aim for the stars, land on the moon type of situation. So I think like those are kind of like the two key things. And the final one that a lot of people don't think about is distribution. You really, really have to nail down how you're gonna scale or acquire your users. The beauty is, in the earliest days, you don't necessarily need to have everything figured out. It's okay to do things that don't scale. You know, with Bundle, in the early days, I remember messaging everyone on WhatsApp and sending broadcasts like, oh, I just made this thing, please download the app. I don't know how many users we got from there, maybe like, I don't know, like 200. My friends want to download Bundle or use Bundle.
Yeah.
You probably should have bought Bitcoin then, but it's there.
They didn't buy, right?
You have to do unscalable things, right? Like, there are some of our community members that I remember who were in our first WhatsApp group, and they made it all the way to Telegram, and they're still very supportive of the product till today, you know? So if you think about those three things, market, problem, distribution, and you're able to sort of like attack all of those three variables, then you stand a good chance of doing well.
Yeah, thank you so much, Yele. So now we'll go into questions from the audience. How much more time do you have for us?
Well, thanks very much for having me, guys. Thank you so much,
Yele. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us on this live fireside chat, Invest in the Future. You can learn more about Future Africa at www.future.africa. And you can join us to invest in 20 startups every year in our exclusive community called the Future Africa Collective. You can also learn about that on our website at future.africa. Thank you so much. We'll be sending you an email in a couple of days with a link to this recording. So please share with your family and friends. Have a wonderful week. Thank you so much, Yele. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Thanks, Benjamin.
Thank you for listening to that Invest in the Future episode. Please follow us on social media. Our handle is at An African Future on all platforms. You can join Future Africa to co-invest in these innovators who are turning Africa's biggest challenges into global business opportunities by joining the Future Africa Collective, our exclusive community of co-investors. Please find more information and apply at future.africa/collective. Thank you for listening once again.